Please.
Okay. Well, good morning and welcome to United Lodge of Theosophists. We are located here at 1917 Walnut in the city of Philadelphia. This has been a beacon of light and hope for over, 100 years in Philadelphia, or 80 years?
No, 1925. You figure it out.
Since when, 1925?
1925.
1925, all right, you figure it out, okay. Well, we've been here, we've been as a place where these ideas of theosophy can be discussed openly, and for us to better understand their true meaning. So to do this, we provide two weekly meetings, one on Sunday mornings, which of course you're well aware of. And on Sundays, things are going to change a little bit. We all love change. But just to give a chance for us to recreate on Sundays. Is that what it's called?
Yes.
Yeah, we're recreating. So in the month of August, there are no Sunday meetings in August. Okay, there are Wednesday evenings, and we're devoted this summer to the Bhagavad Gita. That class is on Wednesday evenings from 7:30 to 8:30. And now there's a library in this building where we have, as the Buddhists would call, commentaries on all these ideas that are professed or talked about, or as the truth as put forth by theosophy. So where you can test, check, and verify for yourself the truth of these ideas. Otherwise, the problem that exists in our society is people do not know how to think, nor do they want to, because they have been lulled into a hypnotic state. And ideas, as we will see this morning, and words are very powerful. So on Wednesday evenings, 7:30, 8:30, the library is open at 5:15 to 7:15. On Wednesday evening, you come in, you have something that you're curious about and you want to talk about, or you know, if you want to talk theosophy, just can't do it in the library, because the librarian is very strict, no talking. So you can come out here into the library, but you know, this is where we come together. We are an association of students, and that is put forward in our declaration. One that we hold to, and we state publicly as a way for us to communicate with each other and hopefully with the world. So
you jumped past July. The Sundays in July.
Oh, we wouldn't want to do that.
No, that's the next Sunday.
No. Next Sunday. Oh, my. And it's such an exciting month that we are reading copies of the material or provided Sunday, I'm sorry, by William Q. Judge, his letters on certain ideas and topics. Next Sunday will be Coping with Despair. Theosophically, how would one approach that?
And they can get a copy of the material.
And there's a copy of the material. But the whole month sounds like, gee, it would be a big help. How to cope with doubt. How to cope with impatience. How to cope with suffering. And then the finale is the influence of the three qualities, which will blend in with the Gita classes on Wednesday. So we have an exciting schedule. In August, we'll be able to rest your brain on Sunday morning. Not really. No rest for the brain. just for the body. Okay, and then in September, still part of the summer schedule, we begin readings from Robert Crosby on right attitude, right use of personality, right use of our faculties and the nature of fellowship, which are all very interesting and thought-provoking and inspirational. So this is our declaration. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes, and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Our class this morning is on ideas and words. Is that the full title?
The power of words and ideas. And since you're the idea person, you should get that straight.
Oh, yes, I should.
Yes.
Because ideas do come first. In fact, ideas always come first. Always come first. In fact, that's the phenomenon that is quite penetrating. Where do these ideas come from? Well, you grow up and you have all these ideas in books. And if you learn the ideas, you can learn more things. And keep on adding on to that idea.
Well, you'll have to wait because words come first. True? True. You can't express an idea without the words.
Well, of course.
And the words we just heard in the declaration were primarily from the editorials written by Mr. Judge in his magazine, The Path. So we have words that were unrelated that were taken and put together to give us a policy of principles, the importance and power of words. Then last Sunday, we had a wonderful talk on the pledge of Kuan Yin, words of compassion, and our goal, our striving to encompass those words, to be on that path of compassion. If we turn to Mr. Judge, we find a most amazing statement in letters that have helped me. Use with great care those living messengers called words. Words are alive, and when they leave you, they leave with your motive, your intent, your feeling. And therefore, they have power. Although we can later talk about mantrams, which shows that a word can have power without that influence of the individual behind it. But Mr. Judge gave much advice about words. Actually, in the 1985 edition of the Funk and Wagnall Standard Dictionary, Mr. Judge was listed as the editor of Theosophic Terms. Now, when we looked at one in the 70s, that was still true, but now it's the World Book. We don't know if that accreditation is still there. But he said that a college course isn't necessary. You don't need a huge vocabulary. What you need is sincerity and energy and effort. But if you have the additional education, it's added to your intuition and compassion and makes you even more valuable. Therefore, he stressed, go to the dictionary. His exact words, I am constantly in the habit of consulting the dictionary and of thinking out the meanings and the correlations of words. Do the same. It is good. Now, one of the things that if you follow Mr. Judge's advice, you begin to be astounded by the meanings of some things. Words that we take for granted, like atmosphere. So what? What the atmosphere? If you look it up in the dictionary, it's atmosphere. It says it all in one word. Then if we turn to things like the Christmas myth, Jesus born in Bethlehem, we think that's a place. But if we go to the dictionary, we discover that Bethlehem means the house of bread. The spiritual being is born into the house of bread or flesh, because spirit can only work directly with others here in the house of bread. There are words, of course, we can't necessarily look up, not having foreign dictionaries, but a student used to come here who was, her family was from Hungary. And when she went to visit her grandmother in Hungary, we asked, since Hungary's name is Magyar, which means magic, we asked if she would ask her grandmother, what do Buda and Pest mean? They're two cities opposite each other across from a river. What do their names mean? If the country is named Magic, what do Buda and Pest mean? And when she returned from Hungary, she said, you're going to be so sad. It's such a disappointment. I said, okay. She said, Pest means oven. And I said, you don't even have to say another word. Buddha must mean fire. She said, yes, how did you know that? And I said, because that's pure theosophy. What is an oven without the fire? What is a fire without the oven? You need the house of bread, the house of flesh. Fire has to enter into an instrument. And if you stop and take that whole thing, Budapest, Hungary, and consider that there is a river in between the oven and the fire, you have the whole of the philosophy. We are told, again, almost all these words are Mr. Judge's. The most common sense, simple presentation of theosophy, free from vagueness and big words, is the best. And then he says, and we should take this to heart, write if we can, if we have any skill. We need a literature, not solely for highly intellectual persons, but of a more simple character, which attempts to appeal to ordinary common sense minds. And then he reminds us we mistake words for knowledge. We think because we can say something that we know it. We should realize we are dependent on these great and grand ideas and do our best to put them into words, but also do our best to understand them. Truly become students, wrestle with these things, and we're reminded that when you feel at home with an idea, you probably did that work in other lives. Move past it to the things you don't understand, to where the struggle is. It's good for you and it's good for the work. Then we are told, using simple thoughts, pure words. H.P. Blavatsky states, humanity, and this is in The Voice, may be likened to a harp with two sets of strings. When words are shared that compassionately arise, they become transmitters of spiritual realities. One soul speaking to another can pass on spiritual realities. That's a beautiful thought. And we may often find that happen in families, in complete silence. You can feel that beautiful exchange. But some things are too high for words, Mr. Judge says. And when we approach the subjects, we're not able to give expression to our thoughts. We don't live up to our highest soul possibilities. And that presents us from reaching to the high thoughts of the far past. But it's our own weakness. And we can fix it. We can work on it. Words become alive in proportion to the reality and purity of the thought that is behind them. You know, we're so lucky having the internet. Granted, you have to use discrimination. There's a lot of garbage out there that claims to be wise. But one of the things you can do is go on a wonderful search. Type in the word theosophy and then the word words and see what it comes up with. But we're told, watch words. They are traps. Catch ideas. It's not the words, it's the ideas the words are trying to express. The wrongful acts or thoughts of others are heat. Coolness is to be produced by discharging the mind of those and ceasing to refer to them in words. And this is Mr. Judge's warning. Otherwise, the engendered heat will continue. Now that tells you two things. One, don't gossip, ever. Because you don't know if what you're passing on is true, and it generates heat anyway. And the other thing, especially in our day and age, go on a news diet. Hear something once, watch it so you know and understand what is being talked about, and then do the best you can to ignore it in the sense of the visuals coming at you from the television, which just generates heat in your mind and heat in the universe. Read and study and think about things, but don't dwell on them. Equally, a few books well read, well analyzed, and digested are better than reading many more books. And then a serious warning, which we'd like to read the whole thing. A single word of ours may have an influence for a lifetime upon another. It may cause once more the fire of passion to blaze up or bring about a great change for good. We may be the means of another's being late for an appointment and thus save him from calamity or the reverse, and so on infinitely. We are responsible beings. We are here because we intended to be here. And because we have things to be worked out, we need ideas, better ideas, purer ideas, truer ideas. I know you have some.
What we have here is an idea. We live in an idea. We have an idea about ourselves. We have an idea about our world we live in. We have an idea about everything. They're just ideas. And we react to them because we have an idea about them. Everything is an idea. What I see right now may be real, but only for a moment, a second. And then it's changing, it's moving on. We're in this slow progress of time. Ideas rule the world. We always thought that was a sort of a cute saying, ideas rule the world. And but when we come to think about it, they do. Our government rules by ideas. Our religions rule by ideas. We rule ourselves by ideas. So it's all about the ideas. Well, and looking where ideas come from, you come to the first principle. That which is eternal, balanced, immutable, omnipresent. There is that, what they call cosmic pre-ideation. But inherent in everything is intelligence. Is intelligence. And here we have us, matter and spirit. And we've built a bridge between that matter and spirit. And that bridge is the mind. The mind becomes that bridge to our higher being. So the ideas that we hold to be true, the world that we live in today, it's a result state. It's an effect state. Why? Because of the ideas that have been held for the last century or so, or multiple centuries. Are the ideas or the things that happen to a country when they become a conquering nation? What happens to their psyche? What happens to their very being? Everything changes. You know, our image of ourselves perhaps doesn't change, but our reality has changed. So how do we gain that insight? How do we gain that rational seeing? How do we gain the true idea of what is really happening? Where are the realities, or what are the realities? And that's called life. We journey through life trying to discriminate to our best ability the ideas that we find ourselves living with. It's the ideas we live with. How we feel about ourselves, how we feel about others. Well, it's basically how we feel about ourselves that radiates right out into the world. And it says that ideas are magnetic. So words are dynamic. They're put into motion, these magnetic forces. So that's another aspect of our responsibility as thinking human beings who make choices, is this idea and words. It's very powerful because there is where our meditation lies. Not in the outside world, within ourselves. What are the ideas that we hold? What are the ideas we entertain? What do we act on? What ideas do we act on? What, you know, and we have to examine ourselves. You can't point your finger in someone else's eye and say, yeah, I know what's wrong with you. No, you have to take care of ourselves. We have to clean up our own backyard. We have to really reevaluate yourself as a human being. Even though we've grown up in a world where we have been programmed or taught to act and behave in certain ways. But comes a time in life that you see those for what they are. So everything becomes a question. Everything becomes an idea. So that's why we're mind beings, because we're so curious. We want to know the truth. And ideas are the path to the truth. And ideas do rule the world. Every political government in the world, every atrocity, all ideas of separateness, bigotry, hatred. But we'll stop, and everybody's looking at their watch. I think I said enough. Right? So,
yes.
Can we make an analogy between? It was said that the ideas come first, and then the words. And then we're thinking of behind will stands desire. Like you have to have the will, which is moves the desire, just like you have to have the ideas to make the words. So it almost sounds like they're the same.
But the opposite can be said to what you said. You said you have to have the will, but you have to have the desire to arouse the will. So you have to have the idea to call upon the need for words. Mr. Judge said that our English language is really pathetic for the task that we're trying to accomplish, that it's a language created out of piracy, is what he called it, and war. And although it adopted words from other languages, it was still for its own commercial sake. So we have never created a language to help us develop our spiritual intelligence. And one of the masters said, trying to use English to express these ideas is like trying to make a fine carving using an axe. So we have to develop our own understanding of words in order to have these ideas be fresh in our minds.
And the fact that ideas are eternal, they're part of universal mind. You know, they're not going to come down to us, but we have to clear that path, build that bridge between spirit and matter, so that the ideas are able to materialize. And therefore, the idea of universal brotherhood becomes more and more a reality. But
and we think we've all experienced understanding something, but we can't put it into words yet. We don't have the way to express it, even though in our mind and our heart, we feel and know it.
Well, but you're allowed to make words up. All right? You're allowed to make words up. And then you can go back to the dictionary later on and see if you can find it. All right? We're sorry. Go ahead.
Does it take a Mahatma to look directly upon an idea, or can every average person do that? Or is it something that the average person can develop?
We do it all the time. We may color and misinterpret it, but someone close to us says something, and instead of hearing what they say, we have colored that idea and we react to it as though they said something else. We don't know any other way to put that. We are looking directly at their idea through our colored glasses. We don't have to do that. There was a a psychological maneuver that people were asked to do, which is a very good idea, and it's to reverse the roles. You pretend to be the other person that you're having a difficulty with, and then you begin to see that their ideas are what are interfering between the two of you. So we think you can look directly at ideas, but we don't want to.
Well, but we also find though within the world in which we live, intellectuals that have a very keen perception of reality. They understand things that we don't see, we don't read, we're not curious about, but they read everything. And they see things very clearly. But that is just on the material plane. When it comes to an eternal reality, they don't, that philosopher doesn't see it. So therefore he doesn't comment on it. It doesn't exist. But we find those amongst us that have clear, they have so much common sense it scares us. Because they just have a, you know, they just know, they, you know, why do you want to do that for him and create all this turmoil and problems? Why do you want to do that for him? And I say, and you look at them and you go, where have you been all my life? Do you have a follow-up?
To the previous thing, we just had another question.
Well, we'll go to the back. Back.
This would be a new point.
Yes.
We're allowed one new point.
Okay. One of the wonderful experiences that each of us can explore is language acquisition. By trying to learn a new language, we force ourselves into a metaphysical and a human state of trying to understand sound, trying to make sense of that sound, gradually after hearing it and getting it, then trying to speak it, and then trying to read and write it. And that process parallels the coming forth of the universe. It parallels the role of the higher working through the lower, and it's something we can experience and then use as an analogy in everyday life.
Mm-hmm. And it's also good for the mind and for the brain to make that effort to try to learn a new language. And again, the ease of the internet, you can go on and through several courses, I think they cost money, but you can have, what's the word? Haha, that's funny. Where the computer repeats the sound back to you so you can hear if you're saying it correctly. We think that's the most difficult thing for Americans, is we're embarrassed by the way we poorly pronounce foreign languages. And then if you make the mistake of going to Europe and just being in a place where you see normal people talking to each other simultaneously in five languages, it is absolutely humiliating. But then if the people in New Jersey and Delaware each spoke a different language from us, we would be that facile. But we're stuck in one big area where we're all speaking the same language, as pitiful as it is.
Well, you know, I think HPB said that the most of the population is mentally lazy.
And obtuse, yes.
And obtuse,
yes.
All right? So you can't be mentally lazy and obtuse and come out of these rooms without a little bit of a sharpened point, all right? Because these ideas are not for the mentally lazy. But you can see why the population of this country has been hypnotized or mesmerized. TVs and all these distractions and, you know, life has taken on a frivolous notion. And people are more easily controlled that way, but that's another conversation. But we have to develop critical thinking so that when we get ideas, we know how to put them into words and what words should be used.
He's had his hand up a while.
So it was said during one of the talks, ideas rule the world, and we rule ourselves through ideas. We project to the world what we are, unconsciously usually, most of the time, who we are and how we feel and our attitudes. So if we look at, like, in the philosophy, we're supposed to try to spread, broadcast these ideas. So if we look at a radio station, for example, there's a certain frequency, and the frequency, you know, that we put out. But we can change our station. We can each change our station in life. And that's what philosophy is all about, and especially theosophy. So, you know, we're not stuck in the one station. We can liberate ourselves. We're greater than these. You know, we are not our bodies. We are not our thoughts. We're not our feelings. We can change our ideas. We can radically change our ideas when we're given proof that they're false. And it doesn't take much investigation to find out that a lot of our ideas just don't serve us and really are not true.
Which is why people come to these ideas. They're already searching. There's a dissatisfaction there. But we're thinking what you just said relates directly to the Bhagavad Gita, because we may not be able to change our circumstances at all, whether it's physical or mental, whatever the condition, but we change our attitude about those conditions, and the minute we do that, we are in a different incarnation.
That's what we meant. We change our station. We, in a sense, we can't, maybe we can't become a king, but we can change our approach. We can mentally change our station. If we can't change our conditions, we can still rise above them mentally by changing our stance.
Exactly.
By changing our ideas,
yes,
that we hold to be true. I've said that over and over again today.
But that's what makes us stand.
Well, I know. Well, we have to change our ideas. And when we come to theosophy, we expect, all right, we hear the truth. We're going to change. And it's a struggle. Because everybody around me, you know, they're looking at you like, well, what do you know that we don't know? And all of a sudden, the change becomes very slow. It becomes gradual. It becomes you're eating something, and you come and eat it once a week, twice a week, go home and you eat some, and you have to digest it. And if you can't apply it, you don't see where it plugs into your world, this idea, then you're not going to hold on to it. It's just another idea. You know, I've been told a lot of ideas, and most of them weren't true. So this is where we come to the idea of words.
Yep.
But in theosophy, we are taught to not to accept anything blindly, but rather test, check, and verify.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to have this great voluminous vocabulary, how do we test, check, and verify all those words to make them, to find out whether they're true or whether they're false? But there has to be an individual testing of these ideas.
The fact is, we're taught that the ancient wisdom religion was the effort of wise beings from another period of evolution who came and laid the foundation. And then as those arose who wanted the wisdom, they tested and checked it and verified it. And nothing was accepted until it was self-proven that way. Now, what do we do with this, for example, the secret doctrine? And much of the words in the secret doctrine are to help us overcome our twisted ideas about many of the words and meanings. So we go through that book, and if we're wise, we will underline in pencil a word we don't know, look it up, write it in the margin, so the next time we come to that, and the secret doctrine is something to be read over and over, is we now have the meaning of the word right there. By the fourth time we read it, we don't even need to look at the meaning. We know that word. So we educate ourselves. Or if it's a concept, and many of us go through this, that's so far over our heads, like absolute abstract motion, what? Well, we underline that and we collect any reference we can. We don't have to understand it at this point. We have to realize we don't understand it and see what we can bring to it that we do understand. We are not expected to be able to write a secret doctrine. We are expected to be able to study it, to apply ourselves to it.
We're on a journey. We're on a journey, all each and every one of us. And we came here because we wanted some advice, some guidance, because we had tried everything else with no satisfaction. So these ideas are what set us free. But it's the ideas. And that, so our encumbrances, our roadblocks, are just simply old ideas that we've had that we just need to let go of. Nothing, you know, nothing is going to happen. What is the worst that's going to happen to us? We're going to die.
No, that's the best.
Well,
if
you're, right now we're here. All right, that's the worst thing. But when we're dead, it's not. But it's just a change of consciousness. Just a change of consciousness, like we go to sleep at night. But we think we need to be perfect. We think we need to, all this stuff is going on. And how do we rectify it? Well, do what best seems unto you. Just keep on trying. You're not going to be perfect. And if you think you are, you got a problem. All right? Because this is all for us, a journey of discovery. I can't hear you. Could you sing it for us?
The old spiritual, if I be lifted up, I will draw all men unto me. Likewise, we were surprised to find something like that in the Gita. If I be lifted up from out of terrestrial life, the supernal, I will draw all men unto me. So it seems
we think first, back to the point that was made by the co-chair, is that it's ourselves we have to lift up and purify. If we have the idea that we are going to rush around and save and educate others, we're very mistaken. It's ourselves we have to work on. when we get to the point where we're beginning to be even a little bit wise, we will attract the very people around us who need what we're learning. Not what we know, but what we're learning. So we share the wisdom, not our wisdom, but the wisdom.
That's why we come here. That's why this student comes here, to share this, so that we can better articulate these ideas, because they are grand ideas, and they're freeing, and they have a lot of power. And sometimes when we speak them, we sort of crumble. Our mind becomes jelly, and we forget what we're doing or what it really means, or we don't want to be confrontational. We don't want to, you know, get anybody angry. And we have 10 million reasons just not to be who we want to be, that idea of who we want to be. Yes?
Yeah, I understand when you were talking about the relationship between ideas and words. Now, let's say the secret doctrine, I assume that when it was written back in the 1800s, it was done in a Western style with the alphabet and words to communicate these ideas. Now, I'm not aware of it, and if you are, I'd like your thoughts on it. Can that document, the secret doctrine, be translated into, let's say, Chinese, where they don't use the alphabet, but they use characters to bring forth ideas? Would you get the same meaning?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, because it is based on the ancient wisdom, which belonged to the Chinese long before the West was developed. The whole point of the secret doctrine, we're told, is that it is not an intellectual study. It is to awaken our own intuition. That in other cultures, China, Egypt, Greece, we have already touched and tasted this wisdom. And maybe even, as Mr. Judge says in the Gita notes, maybe we have even reached some higher level of understanding. But in order to go further, we have to fix the problems that we have that stand in the way of going further. Mm-hmm. Whether it's greed or anger or lust, whatever it is, we have to clean up our nature so we can progress. So yes, it could be done in pictograms. In any language, truth underlies that language, because every culture had a religion or a philosophy that was based upon true wisdom, an actual worker from the lodge of brotherhood that began it or developed it.
And now, when you look at the secret doctrine, and you're going to use it as a tool for study and for inquiry, you are elevated. Something happens because you begin the intuitive quality that pervades that entire book is aroused within us, because it points to something inherent within our very deepest nature. You know, this idea, ideas are eternal. There's an eternal, our universal mind, a universal font of this. And we have no contact with it because we're isolated into this darkness or this material world. But as this bridge that we build between matter and spirit, it gets stronger and bigger, we can cross over. And we can use that knowledge from our higher spiritual nature and those ideas to uplift all of nature, uplift everything to a higher state of consciousness. So, I mean, that's called evolution. But the secret doctrine, even though it's in English and it's not in a cuneiform or in symbols, still is very powerful. The words are awaken the mind in ways which are very subtle. And she tells us that. And it's not written, it's written to arouse our intuition, to check, test, and verify, and inquire, and question everything. And question what you know to be true against what she's saying is true. And this is how we become a dynamic human being. We're thinking about things. We're not just passively accepting life as it comes to us. And the secret doctrine helps us do that. It just helps. You got to do the rest.
So it's the ideas that are more important than words.
Yes.
For example, you know, we talked about the Tao Te Ching, and I collect, you know, translations of it, and it seems to be different. But the ideas tend to be the same.
Right. Right.
Yes, individuals color, and that's one of the problems with theosophy. If you were here on Wednesday night, you heard the purpose of ULT and how its effort to keep those original writings, the original ideas out there, because if you go online, you will find all kinds of statements made that are absolutely not theosophy, that don't agree with the original writings. So it's the ideas that matter and not the coloring by anyone or the words or trying to make it more and more fancy. You know, Mr. Judge, what was said of him was it was the simplicity of his words. He was able to go directly to the heart of a subject and give it to you without all of the color and drama that other people will put on words. So we're looking for ideas, and the words in themselves are not that important.
Well, I think that's something we all strive to do, is to be able to see the idea behind what is going on. Because it's an idea. And oftentimes, when we see that what idea is motivating everyone, all of a sudden everything becomes very, we understand it perfectly now.
Yes.
We need to consider, if we think about a translation of the secret doctrine.
Yeah, speak up, please.
When we talk about a translation of the secret doctrine, we have to realize that any kind of a philosophical or religious work that's written from one language to another, or even from one epic to another, the legitimacy of the translation is a function of the intelligence and spiritual insight of the person doing the translation. So we can have you know, Shakespeare translated into any language, and if one is done by an uneducated man and the other by a highly educated man in that language, the two translations are going to be far, far, far apart.
Well, that's certainly true, but we took the question to mean if someone with wisdom was doing the translating,
right,
then of course, because these ideas were already expressed in the Chinese, and we find it in Lao Tzu, in Confucius. So these ideas are already there. The secret doctrine itself probably is, in ways that we can't even know and imagine, in old temples and things, because these ideas are as old as humanity.
Well, one of the things that these stanzas of Zan in the 1800s say that, yeah, she made it up. Yeah, there's no such tablets. And I think they found them in a monastery in southern Tibet. There's a whole sect that hold these tablets in their sanctuary. So they actually do exist. And as far as translations, when we read things that are outside of the theosophical nomenclature or world, we are suspect about everything. But things that we read that were written by H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge and Robert Crosby, I know they're translated into France, into Spanish and all other language. It's what they wrote, and that seems to be our test. I don't know if it's a test, but yes.
Just to finish the sentence that we started earlier, the perfect example of an accurate translation, perhaps, by someone who is qualified to write in both languages would perhaps be Mr. Judge's rendition of the Gita. You can read a lot of different Gitas in English, but our understanding is Mr. Judge, being absolutely fluent for in certain special ways in Sanskrit and simultaneously in the same lifetime in English, someone like that could do a perfect translation, and so we're very fortunate to have his rendition.
Yes. And we would remind everybody, if you have never taken advantage of it, Mr. Judge's hidden hints in the secret doctrine is like a passport to travel in a way you never knew you could. It's fantastic.
Can I say something?
No.
You know,
you're asking?
I've read a lot of different people's wisdom, you know, different books. And for me, even a long time ago, what a person is saying, the information that they're getting, if it does not coincide with what I see, then I have to question. You know, a person can say one thing, but if they say something is going on, and you're looking at the situation and you see it in a different manner, then you kind of question the wisdom of that person,
well,
or knowledge.
Well, I think they call that lying.
Huh?
They're lying.
Right.
Yeah, that's a lot of that going on in politics.
Right.
You know, but yeah, the truth is not being told, and that's why we come here, because we know it's the truth understood
right.
by some.
And we are told that the Buddha said, "Don't believe anything, even if I say it, unless it agrees with what you know." And experience. So in other words, you've got to make it your task to rediscover the value of certain words, the value of certain ideas. It all falls back on the individual.
And it goes back to the very one tenet of theosophy and studying this ancient wisdom. Impersonality. Impersonality. It's the hardest thing for us to do, but we will grow like a tree. We need to these ideas don't belong to us. They're universal ideas, and there have been tests, checked, and verified to countless generations of wise and perfected beings, so that they're being presented to us for us to investigate. And if we can't make them a living power in our life, they don't mean anything. So we have called this forth, whether you know it or not.
Mm-hmm.
We've called this forth, and here we are doing this again. Yes, I'm sure we have done this many times before. So the effort, the dynamic impulse of ideas, we hope is helping this city. We hope it's helping our families. We hope that it's helping those around us. Because these are the ideas of hope, of the only hope that exists. And it lies within us. We create our own destiny. It is time. Would you like to close with a...
No,
you
just
want to beg for money?
Well, we are
you're
entirely
good
supported by donations. We don't pass the hat. We don't have any special funds and fees. We depend on those who want to see this continue. It's as simple as that. Meeting is adjourned.
Very good. I thought, what did I do wrong? She took it. Didn't she take it?